Welcome back to How to Tickle Yourself. I am your host, Duff McDonald. We have a very special guest today who has a lot to say about the convergence of two of our favorite subjects here at How to Tickle Yourself, Vedanta and music. Dr. Jeffrey D. Long is the Carl W. Ziegler Professor of Religion, Philosophy, and Asian Studies at Elizabethtown College in Central Pennsylvania. He's taught there since receiving his doctoral degree from the University of Chicago's Divinity School in the year 2000. He is the author of several books, including Jainism, An Introduction, Hinduism in America, A Convergence of Worlds, and Discovering Indian Philosophy, An Introduction to Hindu, Jain, and Buddhist Thought, which will be released in February of next year. He's also published a wide array of articles and has spoken at a variety of venues, both national and international, including three talks at the United Nations. He received initiation into the Vedanta tradition of Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda in 2005, and is a regular speaker at Vedanta societies and Hindu temples across the U.S. But here's where it gets interesting. Dr. Long, like many of us, is a lifelong fan of the Beatles, and George Harrison in particular. His book on Jainism includes a section on George Harrison, and he's given talks on the influence of Vedanta in Harrison's music. Fans of George Harrison will know about the very obvious influences in his legendary solo album, All Things Must Pass, but there are hints of Harrison's Hindu influences in many Beatles songs as well. We're so excited to speak to Jeff about so many things: Hinduism, George Harrison, Sri Ramakrishna, Swami Vivekananda, Sri Aurobindo, and the Bhagavad Gita. So settle in, it's going to be a long one. Welcome to the show, Jeff. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm grateful to be here.
At the present moment, traveling town to town, the mystery of the motion, right here, right now, right here, right now, whoa, right here, right now.
So I was telling listeners, I was telling Jeff that just before when I was writing his intro this morning, I stumbled on a depository of the papers that he's written on these various subjects a couple hours ago and fell into the most wonderful rabbit hole of all time. I think I read 8 academic papers in the last 3 hours, and I was running upstairs to tell my wife how amazing they all are. But let's back up. So one thing I would love to get from you, and I know from your writing that you have the clearest way of talking about these things, can we do a few definitions? What is Vedanta? What is yoga? What is Hindu Dharma?
Okay, very good. So, as all good philosophers will tell you, you need to start by defining your terms. So
sure.
Let's do that. All right, so Vedanta is a Sanskrit word. Most of these are Sanskrit words. So Vedanta means the end of the Veda. And that is a bit of a pun. It has a double meaning. So if you look at the Veda, that is the collection of writings that are held in the Hindu tradition to be most sacred, the Veda is composed of different sections. And the portion that comes at the end of the Veda, it's a collection of writings called the Upanishads. And Upanishad itself has several meanings, but it's often translated as secret teaching. Of course, today the secret is out. You can read the Upanishads on the internet. But in ancient times, Upanishad basically refers to something your teacher leans close and whispers to you. And it consists of the end of the Veda in the sense of being the final word, you could say. What the Veda has been leading up to is the secret that is conveyed in the Upanishads. And that secret, I'm going to let the secret out, which again, it's been out for centuries, is that the essence of existence, the infinite reality from which all actuality and possibility emerges is identical with our own self. Mm-hmm. That we, being part of that infinite reality, partake of that same spiritual essence. So we are that fundamentally. And the so that is Vedanta. Yoga is also a Sanskrit word. It's cognate with our English word yoke, and it refers to something which unites or reins in, you could say, the mind and its scattered energies, and reconnects us back to our authentic self. And of course, the classic text of yoga is the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali. It defines yoga as, in Sanskrit, all these things sound better in Sanskrit, but he describes yoga as chitta vritti nirodha, which means the cessation or the calming of the waves of the mind, the modifications of the mind. And Swami Vivekananda uses a beautiful metaphor to describe this. He said, imagine the mind, not the brain, that's the physical organ of consciousness, but mm-hmm. the mind, our center of consciousness. If you can visualize that as a lake, as a body of water, it has waves on the surface. If you look at a lake with waves on it, you really see nothing but waves. But when we calm the waves of the mind, calm the waves of consciousness, then a couple of things happen. When you look at a calm body of water, you can see reflections. You can see mountains and trees and yourself. And in the same way, our mind, when it's calm, it accurately reflects the reality around us. Right? Our reality is normally often distorted by our desires and our fears. Similarly, when you look at a calm body of water, you can see beneath the surface. You can see fish swimming underneath. You can see the pebbles down below. Similarly, we can see deeper into our own mind, our own consciousness, when we calm the waves on the surface, which represent our thoughts, our emotions. And so yoga is the process of calming all of that. Now, listeners might wonder what that has to do with stretching in the gym and mm-hmm. yoga pants and all of these things. And this has all emerged because practices were developed in India long ago to aid this practice of meditation, this practice of yoga, this calming of the mind. And those practices were found to themselves have healthy benefits. They do good things for the body. And so the body being a big focus of our Western civilization, something you can do to feel healthier and to live longer and to look younger and so, is very attractive to people. So they're often drawn to that. The meditative part may be emphasized, it may be not in the modern sort of Western approach, but the original concept is really all about mind and consciousness. So the body is the vehicle for that. So that's yoga. Hindu dharma, I'll take the term dharma first. It's the basic order of existence. The universe is not a random place, according to the teachings of the ancient Indian traditions. What often appears to be chaos is just a highly organized system that we don't understand yet. To us, it seems to be chaos. Once you get to know it, it makes perfect sense. Right? So there is an order of things. That order manifests at various levels of existence. So you could call the laws of physics a manifestation of dharma. But the dharma that the Hindu texts are most often concerned with is human beings' dharma, which means how do we fit into society with one another and into the larger cosmic framework. So if you ask the average Hindu, what does the word dharma mean? They'll usually say duty or responsibility. And that's connected to that idea of cosmic order because, well, your duty is an effect of your place in that order. Mm-hmm. And your place in that order is an effect of all of your past choices that you've made, not just in this life, but in countless lifetimes. Hindu dharma refers to that specific set of teachings and ways of living and practices that we today call by the name Hinduism. But that name is a relatively recent phenomenon. But it is a name that Hindus increasingly today wear with pride because it's a very old collection of traditions. There's a lot of wisdom there. And India is experiencing a bit of a resurgence. It was colonized. It was really sort of crushed under the heel of European domination for a long time. And it became an independent country back in 1947. And increasingly, people around the world are beginning to see and appreciate the things that India and its traditions have to offer, including people like George Harrison, right, who reached the apex of wealth and fame and found that he was no happier than before. In fact, to some extent, less so. And when he first heard Indian music, he said it made more sense to him than anything he'd ever heard. He felt drawn to it right away, and that was the spark for a lifelong journey. And I think many of us have had experiences of that kind, where something causes us to take a deeper look at this culture and this tradition and all the things it has to offer.
You know, you make a great point. So I stumbled into this realm myself in the last couple of years. And Vedanta, sort of broadly speaking, made so much sense to me. The clarity and the sort of tools for thinking about my own reality. And you quoted someone in one of your papers that I read this morning. I just want you to expand on this idea. I forget who said it. You won't. Vedanta is not a religion, but religion itself in its most universal and deepest significance. Yeah. Who was that?
Sarvapalli Radhakrishnan. He was an Indian philosopher, and he was the, I believe, the president of India. Is it vice president or president? Someone can Google that. He was also, I believe, the ambassador of India, I think, to the Soviet Union for a period of time. Very distinguished statesman, but most known for his contributions to education and to philosophy. He was a philosopher himself, and he also wrote about Vedanta. He wrote about Buddhism. He wrote translations of texts like the Bhagavad Gita, the Dhammapada, which is from the Buddhist scriptures, the sayings of the Buddha, and very, very distinguished Indian thinker of the 20th century.
Okay, so but the point he was making about the sort of catch-all nature of Vedanta, can you get at that point, like what he's actually saying?
Absolutely, yes. He says it's not a religion, it's religion itself, right, in its deepest significance. And what he's saying here is that Vedanta, for those of us who adhere to this philosophy, it's not simply a type of philosophy, a type of Hindu philosophy, a type of Indian philosophy. But if you get into the worldview of Vedanta, it is a conceptual superstructure that enables you to understand, and that in some ways incorporates within itself the insights and teachings of a vast array of world religions. You know, you can find insights that are part of Christianity that fit within the Vedantic framework, right? You can find a lot of elements of Buddhism that fit within the Vedantic framework. You can find aspects of modern science that fit within the Vedantic framework. So it's kind of a universal philosophy, right? A universal philosophy and kind of a universal religion, in the sense that it involves practice, it involves a way of living. Its depth and its breadth are simply amazing. In the modern period, the school of Vedanta, the particular school of thought to which I adhere, was inspired by a teacher named Sri Ramakrishna, who lived back in the 1800s in Bengal. He was not someone who studied extensively, though he did have some books, and he often had people read books to him, and he had a fantastic memory. So he actually knew a lot of texts, but he didn't read them himself. He heard these and absorbed them. And he had a lot of profound experiences through his own practices of meditation and various types of other spiritual practice from many different traditions. So he practiced an array of Hindu traditions, and he practiced for a period of time both Islam and Christianity. He didn't practice these all at the same time. he would take a particular practice and he would pursue it until he had an experience of what the yoga tradition calls samadhi, right? This perfect union between subject and object. So there is you, the seeker, the contemplative, the person who's focused on some spiritual ideal. What that ideal is will vary depending on the tradition. It might be Krishna, it might be the mother goddess, it might be Lord Shiva, it might be the impersonal absolute of the Vedanta tradition, or it might be Jesus, it might be Allah. Whatever your ideal is, you focus on that and pursue that path diligently. And eventually you have this experience, this revelatory experience, in which your practice ceases to be based on belief or faith. It comes to be a form of knowledge. It's experiential. And because Ramakrishna did this in multiple traditions, he concluded that these paths all lead to the same highest reality, experienced differently and perceived differently depending on how it's approached. But ultimately, that reality, he said, is one. He said, some people call water by one name, you know, like if we put it in an American context, you know, if you speak Spanish, water is agua. You know, if you speak German, it's Wasser, right? But if you speak English, it's water. But it's all H2O, right? It's all the same substance, whatever you call it. And so he believed that, and he'd experienced the unity of the divine as experienced in all of these different systems. So the way Vedanta, at least the modern Vedanta that he taught and that his disciples, Swami Vivekananda and his other followers taught, the way it works is it is kind of a conceptual superstructure in which this whole idea of many paths makes sense. Because part of Vedanta, part of contemporary Vedanta, is to go back to yoga, but it's the idea of multiple yogas, right? We all have our own path by which we achieve realization. And these tend to be placed into categories. Indian traditions are very fond of categorizing things and sort of laying everything out in a systematic way. So you'll sometimes hear people talk about the four yogas, for example. And this was Swami Vivekananda's way of talking about this. And you see this going all the way back to the Bhagavad Gita, right? Another important Hindu scripture, which talks about there's bhakti yoga, the path of devotion. There's jnana yoga, the path of knowledge. There is Raja Yoga, the path of meditation, Karma Yoga, the path of action. And none of these is exclusive of the others, but we will be drawn to a certain type of practice depending on our own mental, physical, emotional, spiritual makeup and our cultural background. And of course, what we call the sanskaras, the traces that we bring from all of our past experiences. And the world's religions, you could say, are almost made up of combinations of these yogas, right? You'll see some of them have more of a focus on meditation and wisdom. Some have more of a focus on social action and social justice. Some of them have more of a focus on prayer and devotion. And they're all important, right? They're all different facets of how we experience that infinite reality that we're all part of and that we're here to realize and experience.
Mm-hmm. And I guess this just occurred to me, and it may be self-evident, but that catch-allness of Vedanta is obviously connected to the concept of Brahman, which is the unity of all things. So it's no surprise that it's not a religion, it's the... It includes it all, because if it's all one thing, then it's all one thing.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, I had an interesting interaction a long time ago with someone who was saying to me, you know, which god do you pray to, right? Or which god do you invoke and so on. And this person was Christian, and I said, well, isn't there just one? And it was almost, I almost felt like saying, who's the real monotheist right here? Because he was working with the idea that, you know, there was his God, right? The God he believed. And then other people had their gods. And the Vedantic way of thinking of it, as I understand it, is, well, we might each have our own idea of God, but the reality is what the reality is, right? Mm-hmm. And you see this going all the way back to the oldest of the Vedic texts, the Rig Veda, says, Ekam sat vipra bahudha varanti. The reality is one, but wise people speak of it in many different ways. Right? It is multifaceted. It is infinite. It is beyond anything that any one of us can conceive. So there are many ways to talk about it, many ways to think about it, and they're all to be learned from and respected.
Sure. So I've talked a lot on this program about my own experience in quarantine that led to the writing of Tickled. And the belated discovery of the charms of the Bhagavad Gita at the age of 51. Your story about how you came to this path is really moving, but also profound in its implications, I think. Would you mind sort of recounting what brought you here?
Sure. And I think we're about the same age, it sounds like, from what you just said.
52?
Yeah, well, I'm 54, so okay. I'm ahead by a couple of years. All right, so yes, I came to this path through, there were several facets, several aspects of this, but when I was very young, I grew up in a small town in Missouri. I grew up in the Catholic faith, and I was happy with that. I was not a sort of, a rebel in that sense of, you know, I liked church and even thought I would like to be a priest. My father was in a really terrible accident when I was 10. And then about a year and a half later, his life ended. He actually found a way to end his own life. Hard to believe because he was quadriplegic. But we went through this ordeal of about a year and a half. We meaning he, my mother, myself, and all of our extended family and people who were close to us. And in the wake of that, I became even more interested in religion than I already was. I liked the church and so on, but I became intensely interested in especially the question of the afterlife. What happens next? Does anything happen next? And the question of suffering. Why do things like what happened to my father happen? Is there some meaning or purpose behind it all, or is it just all random? And this became a very urgent question for me. And I found a lot of wisdom in what the church taught. But I also found there were some questions that I was not entirely satisfied with in terms of the answers. Particularly, the idea of an afterlife as such, it was something I felt very drawn to. It seems to me that if you suffer the way my father did, right, his body basically became a prison. And I felt that when his life ended, I felt that he had freed himself from that. I've never blamed him for it. I was never angry with him for it. I was almost like, good for you, Dad, you know, though I felt the loss of his physical presence in my life. But I thought that he had done the right thing for himself and that he was free. If your body could become a prison, that suggests you're not the body. There's the body and there's you, right? I've since lost other loved ones to cancer, right? That's the body essentially turning on itself, right? If your body can turn on you, if it can become your enemy, it's different from you, right? Now, that's not a tight philosophical argument, but it's kind of an intuition. You know, there's me, there's my body. And so it seemed to me to be a perfectly rational thing to say that there's some essence of us that continues on. But then what happens next? So, of course, in Christianity, you have the idea of heaven and hell. That bothered me because in addition to growing up in the church, I also loved science. I was a big fan of Carl Sagan and Cosmos when I was growing up. And I watched that series very faithfully. One of my most treasured possessions is an autographed copy of the book. I actually got to meet him when I was 14, so I got his autograph. So he had something called the cosmic calendar, where he had the whole history of the universe from the Big Bang to the present compressed into one calendar year. And it's interesting, like the Earth itself doesn't even form until about September, right? And all of human history, you know, the last 5,000 to 6,000 years of recorded history is like the last second before midnight on New Year's.
Right.
And I thought, that is just the few billion years that our universe has existed. If heaven and hell are eternal, as the church teaches, that means you're there forever, right? I mean, you can have hundreds, thousands, millions, billions of cosmic calendars worth of time, and you're still just getting started, because I took the idea of infinity very seriously. And it seemed to me that the whatever good or whatever bad we did in this short lifetime, I couldn't see how that could translate into infinity. The idea of hell really bothered me. First of all, I thought my father had already been through hell, right, to some extent. Whenever I was naughty, which wasn't very often, but when I was naughty as a child, my parents would punish me, and they would always say, this is to teach you to be better. But what could eternal punishment be teaching you? It's just this relentless terribleness forever. And yeah, there are people who've done horrible things throughout history. And, you know, we might want to say, you know, if someone like a Hitler, we might say, yeah, maybe he should be in hell for, you know, maybe billions and trillions of years. But forever? I mean, there has to be the hope that we could all at some point improve and change. So the idea of hell, I was never really sold on. But even the idea of heaven, I thought, I was very gratified. Recently, I saw a video of the late John Hick, who's one of my favorite philosophers. And he said something that I've also said for years. And I was like, John Hick, and I thought, what? He said he liked the idea of rebirth. He said, because he didn't know anyone who was bad enough to go to hell or good enough to go to heaven, right?
Uh-huh.
We all have our flaws, and we all have our, you know, most of us are not really evil. We may be short-sighted, maybe a little selfish, but evil is, I would say something that I think I would like to think is relatively rare. I think it's more common than we like to think, but even people who engage in evil, we often see they've been terribly hurt by something and that they're responding to. So there's a larger story there. So what made sense to me was the idea that we just keep coming back until we get it right, right? We just keep learning and learning. There is the idea in the Catholic Church, which I really like, of purgatory, right? You don't just go to heaven right away, but well, you still have some flaws to work out, right? So there's that process of purification. The thing that bothered me about that was, well, what were we doing here in the first place, right? I mean, if you finish here on earth and you still have some work to do, what was the point of this part, right? And so I thought, well, wouldn't it be more economical if this just is purgatory, right? And we just saying that we're already in purgatory. I tell my students that. I said, according to these worldviews that teach rebirth, I said, you've all wondered about, is it, do you want to know what's in the afterlife? They said, yes. I said, this is it. This is the afterlife of your last lifetime. Here you are now. And so, yeah, this is it. And so this all made sense to me. And simultaneously, I think a lot of Americans especially, we get a lot of our ideas from popular culture. So two things happened. I saw the film Gandhi when I was 13, saw that in the theater. I was just blown away by that movie. It's a beautiful movie. Mm-hmm. And I started reading any book or anything I could find about Gandhi, right? I saw so much wisdom in what he was saying. And I was already a Star Wars fan and a Star Trek fan. And I thought, wow, someone who fought evil without a lightsaber or a phaser, right? He used the power of truth and the power of love and of goodness. So I was very moved by that. And more to the point, I think, of our conversation today, the Beatles and George Harrison. And I inherited my dad's record collection. And he was not a huge Beatles fan. He was more of a 70s singer-songwriter kind of guy. So a lot of James Taylor and the Eagles and John Denver. And I grew up on all of those things. But he liked the Beatles. And I had what people now call the Red Album and the Blue Album. It's the big collection of greatest hits from 62 to 66 and 67 to 70. Well, I played that nonstop. I just loved it. And then after my father died, our neighbor, who was also a good friend of ours, he was also the funeral director in our small town, so he knew about everything that happened to Dad. He lent me his three Beatles albums. They were the American version of Help, which has the soundtrack stuff on it, the American Rubber Soul, and then, of course, Meet the Beatles, which was their first Capitol album in America. So I started playing those. I put it all on cassette, and I played them, you know, over and over again. So I started collecting the albums. And when I started listening to George Harrison especially, it was revelatory, right? Because I managed to collect the Beatles albums, and I was like, well, what do you do next? Well, you start getting their solo albums, right? So
right.
I and All Things Must Pass, I mean, it's my favorite album to this day. I mean, there's so much depth, so much profundity in those lyrics and in the music itself. It's just, he pulls you in, really, with that. And so between George Harrison and his references to India and Indian philosophy and Krishna and so on, and Gandhi, I was sort of primed to kind of launch into a study of India and of Hinduism and Hindu traditions. And the book I kept seeing referenced in the various things I was reading at the time, they kept talking about the Bhagavad Gita. Gandhi talked about the Bhagavad Gita. George Harrison quoted from the Bhagavad Gita and some of his album cover art. So I thought, well, I need to find the Bhagavad Gita. And it really was not an easy book to get in Montgomery City, Missouri, where I grew up. So one day I went to a flea market with my grandmother. She would sell arts and crafts. She was very artistic. And I would go with her to help her, but also I would always be on the lookout for like old sci-fi novels and comic books and things like that that you could find at these places. Right? This is long before eBay. She had to actually go to places
and get
people stuff, right? And you know, having the Bhagavad Gita on my mind, but not really expecting to find it there, I went to a table with magazines and it looked like comic books and, you know, some books. I thought, okay, there's the book table. And right on top was the Bhagavad Gita. It was the ISKCON version, the really beautifully illustrated one, the Prabhupada translation. It's called Bhagavad Gita As It Is. And there it is. That is the one. That's with that same cover and everything. Right?
Yeah.
The paper cover on mine wore off a long time ago. I kind of have kept it as an insert. I opened the first page. I opened was a picture of a man who has died, and his mourning family is surrounding him, and there is a Hindu sage standing in the distance, sort of looking very serenely and compassionately at them all, and he can see that God is within all of them, right? He's in this little, it looks like a little Krishna, right, in the heart of everybody.
Right.
And beneath that, there were these words. It says, the wise lament neither the living nor the dead. And that just grabbed me, right? Blew my mind. I was like, because I was very much in a state of mourning. You know, this was 3 years after my father's accident, 2 years after his passing. So I gave a page number. So I turned to the page number, and Krishna is explaining to Arjuna in the Bhagavad Gita, never was there a time when you and I did not exist, nor all these things, nor shall a time come when we shall cease to be. And he talks about how just as a person casts off old and worn off clothing and puts on new clothes, so the soul casts off the body when it's old and worn out and takes on a new body. He says the wise are not deceived by these changes. And so it all clicked, because I was already kind of thinking of this idea of we keep coming back to purgatory, you know, and I was leaning in this direction already. And here was this book from India, from another culture, another civilization, thousands of years ago, saying to me exactly what I had been thinking.
Right.
And I've had a hard time putting that moment into words, but the closest I've come is to tell people that it was like being an extraterrestrial who was raised by humans and then finding an artifact from your home planet. Right. It was like that moment in the old Superman movie with Christopher Reeve where he finds the crystal from Krypton, right? And it leads him to the North Pole, to the Fortress of Solitude. So my Kryptonian crystal was the Bhagavad Gita. And I bought it for a quarter, best quarter ever spent. And I read it. And then whenever I had the opportunity, my mother was always very supportive of my interests. Whenever we would go to usually Columbia, Missouri was the large town near where we lived. Whenever we went to the mall, we'd always go to the bookstore and she'd always say, okay, you can get a book. And so I gradually collected Paramahansa Yogananda's Autobiography of a Yogi, Aldous Huxley's The Perennial Philosophy, about five more different translations of the Bhagavad Gita by different authors, the Tao Te Ching, the Quran.
You know what I'm reading right now?
Which
I just stumbled on.
There you go. Swami Abhedananda's Gita. Yes.
I'm in volume two. It is amazing.
Yes.
There's a it's a bit of a challenge. This one's got some typos. They had some translation issues. But let me segue here into one of my favorite topics of all time. I told you before, Essays on the Gita, Sri Aurobindo.
Yes.
Without a doubt, my favorite book ever. Aurobindo occupies an interesting place in Vedanta and the sort of history of Indian philosophical thought. But I know that you are also a fan.
Yes.
I quote him almost every episode to close the episode. As a scholar of this stuff, can you both for my benefit and for the people who I forced to listen to me read his sometimes lengthy quotations, can you put him in context for us?
Absolutely. So Aurobindo, born in the late 19th century and lived well into the 20th. And he was Indian, but a lot of his early years were spent in the Western world. And in fact, in the UK, he had his education in Cambridge. His father was an Indian civil servant, but this was during the time of the British Empire. So he worked for the British government. And so Aurobindo grew up getting a thoroughly Western education. He read voraciously. He knew philosophy. He knew English analytic philosophy. He knew continental philosophy. He knew his Kant and his Hegel. And, you know, he was very well versed in Western philosophy. Then he went to India ostensibly to be a civil servant like his father, and saw the condition of the people of the country and what the British were doing. So he joined the independence movement. And this was not the Gandhian peaceful movement. This was the, you know, we got to kick these guys out of here movement. And so he was involved in a plot to assassinate a British official. He got sent to prison in the Andaman Islands. And much in the way that some of us, I think, tried to make the best of the COVID pandemic by using the solitude to meditate and to study and to think, Aurobindo spent a very productive time in prison. He did yoga, he studied, but he also delved deep into himself. And by his own account, he had a number of visionary experiences. He had visions of Lord Krishna. He had visions of Ramakrishna, whom I mentioned earlier, and of Ramakrishna's chief disciple, Swami Vivekananda, who famously came to the Western world. And so there are many of us who see Sri Aurobindo as being in a kind of continuity of the lineage with Sri Ramakrishna and Swami Vivekananda. Some people will tell you these are two different schools of thought. Institutionally, yes. There's the Sri Aurobindo Ashram. There's a whole structure that he developed in his lifetime. And his closest disciple, Mira Alfasa, called the mother, who was a French woman, basically took over his organization after his time and continued on manifesting his teachings to the world. But for many of us, there's really no contradiction between them. In fact, he takes certain threads of Swami Vivekananda's thought and elaborates them further. To me, his magnum opus is The Life Divine. It's a massive book.
Yeah.
I see it as a fitting sequel to the complete works of Swami Vivekananda. Just a quick example, there's a term that Swami Vivekananda uses occasionally. He defines it, but he doesn't elaborate on it very much. But he uses this term involution. Involution is the other side of the coin of evolution, right? So we might look from a scientific perspective at consciousness is evolving from simpler life forms, you know, first from matter and then from simpler life forms. But you can also look at it from a spiritual plane as consciousness becoming involved in matter, right? So what looks from one side to be an evolution is from the other side, the descent into the material of the spiritual. And these are, they're two great syntheses. I think there are more than two, but I'm going to talk about two. Two great syntheses that happen in Sri Aurobindo's work. The synthesis of East and West, because he immerses himself thoroughly in Sanskrit and in Indian philosophy in the same way that he did with Western philosophy. So he's equally conversant with both, and there are very few people who can make such a claim. And so he's able to draw on both traditions, and he knows where the strong points are and where the weak points are, and he pulls it together. And then related to that is the synthesis of the material and the spiritual, right? Mm-hmm. That for Aurobindo, it is not simply that we have to transcend the material world and merge with the spiritual, which is our true nature, right? This is more of a classical Vedanta way of looking at it. He says, that's true, but he says, there's also a point to the involution, that spirit manifested in and as this material world for a reason, right? To fully become what it is otherwise only in potential. So spirit has manifested as all of this, right? Brahman has become this whole world. And this is a little closer to Ramakrishna's teaching than it would be to what we call classical Advaita Vedanta. In classical Advaita Vedanta, there's a tendency to talk about the world as sort of illusion,
right? Yeah,
quite real. And what that means, I think, is it's unreal relative to the ultimate reality, but it still has a purpose, right? So Ramakrishna says that after one has attained enlightenment and realize the truth of Brahman, he says there's a step even beyond that, right? He said there's jnana, which is knowledge, but then there's also what he calls vijnana, which is knowledge beyond knowledge. He says that the vijnani, the person with that knowledge, sees that Brahman has in fact become all of this, right? So it's not just that you need to set this aside and focus on God. It's like, this is God too. All of this is God, your God, all of this is God. And so Aurobindo really kind of runs with that idea, right? He talks about the manifestation, the descent of what he calls the supermind and the superconsciousness. This is all, these are all sort of levels and aspects of this broader involution of consciousness into this plane of reality. So yeah, I mean, it's like you have, if you start with the Gospel of Ramakrishna, then you have the complete works of Vivekananda, which kind of puts it in a little more philosophical vein. And then you have the Life Divine, which then kind of brings that into our kind of scientific framework and thinking in the modern world. And it's just beautiful. And then, of course, another important figure I have to mention, because we talk about these men all the time, but the Holy Mother, Sharada Devi, who was the wife, the spiritual companion of Sri Ramakrishna, her wisdom, I think, underlies everything, really. I mean, she is Ramakrishna himself. We talk about someone, we'll say a guy who really loves his wife, we'll say he worships his wife. Ramakrishna literally worshipped his wife. He had a puja, he had a ceremony in which he worshipped her as the mother goddess when she first came to actually live with him. They were married, probably more appropriate to say betrothed, when she was still a child. But when she was 19, she came to live with him and he did this ceremony. And after he passed on, she really became the moving force behind the Ramakrishna movement. Swami Vivekananda and the others wouldn't do anything without her. Okay. So she's another figure. And she never wrote anything, but her sayings have been written down. The wisdom of the Holy Mother has been written down. And it's been retranslated recently by Swami Chaitananda. It's a book called The Gospel of the Holy Mother. And it's definitely worth getting. I love quoting that. I'm looking at a picture of the Holy Mother right now as I'm talking about this, and I'll show you that this is a painting, but it's based on a famous photograph of her that was taken. And
a couple months ago, because I can't stop buying books on this subject, I stumbled on the fact that Vedanta Press and some of the North American prices of books were sort of orders of magnitude higher than if you bought straight from the Ramakrishna Mission in India.
Yes.
But I had to buy enough to rationalize the postage.
Mm-hmm.
Cost,
because the postage is greater than the book. Yeah,
the postage way more than the books.
Yeah.
I ended up, this bottom shelf here is I made a $300 purchase at once I was like, I'm going to get the next couple of years reading here so I can get the cost down, get it sent over from India. And they had, they slipped a bunch of little cards in there, some of which were that photo.
Yes.
And
yes.
Others of, were of Ramakrishna, the one of the famous sons of him, too. Mm-hmm. All right. So moving right along here, because we're burning through time. You gave a talk called The Yoga of Yoda.
Yes.
And in which you point out the significant influence of Vedantic thought in the Star Wars cosmos.
Yes.
Give us one or two of your favorite examples of that.
Well, one of my favorites is when Yoda is teaching Luke Skywalker the nature of the Force. There's a sequence in The Empire Strikes Back, which I call the Bhagavad Gita moment in Star Wars. And I'm thinking of how the 11th chapter of the Gita, Sri Krishna reveals himself in his full glory to Arjuna. And Arjuna is overwhelmed by the vision and asks him to return back to his human form. But he sees that in Krishna, there are all the gods and so on. So the equivalent moment in The Empire Strikes Back is, Luke is learning about the Force, but his mind is still very enthralled by the material paradigm, right? I mean, that's where we all start out. So his X-Wing fighter sinks into the swamp and he's like, oh, we're never going to get that out. And in the scene before that, Yoda had just been showing him how to use the Force to lift stones. And Yoda's like, well, use the Force. And Luke says, well, lifting rocks is one thing, but this is different. And you can tell I've seen Star Wars a lot of times because I quote this. Yoda says, no, not different, only different in your mind. And Luke is very frustrated. He's, oh, you want the impossible, right? He thinks Yoda's giving him a hard time. And then in this wonderful moment, Yoda shows his full glory. He lifts his little three-fingered, green clawed hand into the air and stretches his hand out, closes his eyes, and lifts the X-Wing fighter out of the swamp and deposits it on the ground. And before that moment, right, he's explaining some things to Luke, and he's saying, size doesn't matter. Judge me by my size, do you? Because he's little, right? He says, right. Well, you should not, for my ally is the Force, and a powerful ally it is. And he pinches Luke on the shoulder. He says, luminous beings are we, not this crude matter. And I remember when I saw The Empire Strikes Back in the theater the first time, and this is before I had gotten into Hinduism, but my father was in the hospital at that point. He was in a rehab facility at this point and, trapped in his body. And that moment brought me to tears. I thought, yes, luminous beings are we, not this crude matter, right? Dad is not that body in the hospital.
Wow.
He's far more than that, right? So it really touched me. And then later when I found the Gita, in the, of all places, a flea market put on by the local Methodist church, interestingly. There it was, right? The same teaching, right? The soul doesn't die. It continues on. And so that the spiritual essence of who we are, I think, is such a big lesson in Star Wars. And another favorite scene of mine, and I don't know what people are going to think of this, because the film that a lot of people love to hate is The Last Jedi. It's one of the more recent films, but there's a fantastic scene in that film. I call that the Chandogya Upanishad moment in Star Wars. In the Chandogya Upanishad, there's a dialogue between a father and son. The son has gone and studied the Vedas, and he's come home, and he's full of things he's learned, and he's kind of arrogant, right? And his father decides to, teach him some humility. So he says, okay, you've learned everything that you've learned. Have you learned the knowledge through which all things are known? He says, no, they didn't talk about that in school. So his father begins to teach him through a series of metaphors. Right? So, for example, he has him bring a seed from a tree and he says, break open the seed. And he opens the seed, says, what do you see inside there? He says, I don't see anything. He says, that subtle essence that you cannot see, that contains the essence of this whole tree that's going to grow from the seed. And then he says, that subtle essence that you cannot see, he says, that you are, right? This is the famous tattvamasi, you know, you are that, or that is your nature as well. So he has several of these lessons that he gives his son, and his son becomes enlightened from this. So in The Last Jedi, there's this great scene where Rey wants to learn about the Force. She has a lot of potential in it. And so Luke says to her, now Luke is the wise man, right? Now he's the elder. He's in Yoda's position. And now, like Yoda had to deal with him, he has to deal with this young person who, you know, thinks they know how it all works. And he says to Rey, tell me what you know about the Force. And she says, it's a power the Jedi use to lift things. That's like, she knows. And he says, that's wrong. So, there's several parts of the scene that are quite funny. He says, first he has her close her eyes, take a deep breath, and he says, reach out. He means with her mind, but she's, again, like Luke used to be, she's stuck in the materialistic paradigm, right? So she sticks out her hand. He kind of rolls his eyes. So then he takes this, looks like a palm leaf. He starts to sort of tickle her hand with it. And she says, oh, I feel something. He says, oh, you do? And she says, yes. And he says, oh, that must be the Force. And she gets all excited. Then he smacks her arm with it. A little like a Zen master there, right? He's like, okay. So then he gets her to, you know, close her eyes, breathe deeply, and she starts to perceive the Force throughout this space where they are. They're on an island, and she sees all the different aspects of it, life and death, creation and destruction, and she senses that within herself as well. And he says, that's the Force. And he says, it doesn't belong to anyone. It doesn't belong to the Jedi. It's the... That essence that binds all things. And so this idea of there's a universal essence that is within all of us, this I think is one of the big themes of Star Wars, that where I see a lot of influence of Vedanta. Now, someone could say, well, did that come from Vedanta? I mean, a lot of schools of thought teach similar things, and that's true. At the same time, if you look at Star Wars, you see tons of names that are borrowed from the world of Sanskrit, the world of Indian philosophy. I mean, I don't know where to stop. I mean, there's a Jedi named Shakti. Well, Shakti, that's the power.
All right. Okay. Wow. All right.
You know, Yoda. Yoda comes Sanskrit mean in Sanskrit. There's a word Yodha, which means warrior. Yoda is warrior. So you know, etc.
No argument here.
Yeah.
All right, I got a George Harrison question for you. I think I sent this to you when we were emailing. So there is a, you know, the traditions of the guru and the teacher is, you know, one of the fundamental pillars of Hindu philosophical and spiritual traditions. But there's also, I get the sense that If you have seen the light, you can, even if you're not a guru, you are capable of being an illuminating presence for other people.
Absolutely.
And I read somewhere recently, I'm a huge Dylan fan, and I'm a huge Tom Petty fan. I'm a huge Traveling Wilburys fan.
Wilburys, yes.
And I read somewhere that someone said that they thought that you could, so at the time that the Traveling Wilburys came out, both Tom Petty and Bob Dylan's careers were in slumps. And then George Harrison rolls in, makes two just jubilant and joyous albums with those guys. And then take a look at what happens to Petty's career after that. Into the Great Wide Open.
Wow.
And Free Fallen.
Free Fallen, yeah.
Dylan had, you know, one of his many resurgences right after that. Mm-hmm. So do you buy that idea that what we could be seeing there is the enlightenment, an enlightened person passing it on to those around him?
I would like to think so. I would like to think so. To me, it's very plausible. And when you hear the things that Dylan and Tom Petty have said about George Harrison, especially since his passing, it certainly stands to reason that they that he was a very positive influence in their lives. Tom Petty spoke a lot about his good humor, a lot about his wisdom. Dylan said something very poetic. He said something like he was a giant with the strength of 100 men, right? He said something like that about George Harrison, which is not how we normally think of him, but that reflects something that he saw in him.
Right, clearly.
And they were friends from way, way back. I mean, Dylan more recently released some recordings from 1970, and George Harrison is on a lot of them, just sort of playing guitar, and like they do early run throughs of If Not For You, and right. they do what I consider a very funny version of Yesterday, actually, where Dylan sings Yesterday, and at the end of it you can hear George and Dylan talking, and George says, yeah, we just need to bring the strings in now, you know, because yeah, the original Yesterday had the violins and all, and but yeah, I think he was, and I want to add something to this. I think George Harrison himself had reached a certain peak spiritually around that time, because in my own analysis of his albums that I've been doing, he also had a slump and he had a period where he didn't record at all, right? Like from 83 to 87. Nowadays, that goes by in a blink, it seems like. The Rolling Stones now have their first album of original material in, 18 years or something.
Right.
But in those days, that was a long time. Like if you didn't have an album out every year, it's like, oh, you were old and washed up. And 87, he comes roaring back with his album called Cloud Nine. And it's full of spiritual themes, the lyrics. The music itself is uplifting. He's playing and singing more confidently than ever. My sense is that, and I don't really have evidence for this, I'm talking purely from the music. I know a few things, of course, about his life during that time. I mean, actually quite a bit, but I'm thinking from the perspective of the music that, with All Things Must Pass, and with the music he wrote when he was still with the Beatles, when he started, you know, really coming into his own as a songwriter with Here Comes the Sun and While My Guitar Gently Weeps and so on, you have that burst of the enthusiasm of someone who has just discovered the spiritual path.
Right.
And he's in meditation, and it's all opening up to him. And I think a lot of us have this experience too, that you have that initial burst. And then there's a phase that's a little more difficult. St. John of the Cross famously called it the dark night of the soul. I think of it as, okay, you've hit the spiritual peak, and then it dawns on you that you still have to take the garbage out, and you still have to pay the mortgage, and you still, you know, I mean, life goes on. And also, you change, but maybe the people around you don't. And sometimes they're not always appreciative of what
the
you're
new
doing.
You.
Headed. So if you look at the album Living in the Material World, I think this is where that's really strong. But you also see it in his albums all the way up to Gontrapo in 1983, which is a lot of people considered a very forgettable album. Actually, it has a couple of very beautiful songs on it. But most of his 70s work, there's a very sad undercurrent to a lot of it. Hmm. Where, you know, it's like that realization that, okay, this material world is not my home. And that hurts in the beginning to realize that to some extent, right? You there's a song I really love. It's called "The Light That Has Lighted the World" from Living in the Material World. And George Harrison says, "You know, I hear how some people have said that I've changed, that I'm not what I was. How it really is a shame." And then he says, "It's very strong, hard-hitting lyrics." He says, "So hateful of anyone who's happy or free. They live all their lives without looking to see the light that has lighted the world." And it's judgmental, it's angry, but it's that phase where it looks like you have this burst of spiritual enlightenment, and then you come to the world and you're like, hey, there's this wonderful thing. Hey, Hare Krishna. And people are like, we don't want to hear about it. Right? So it hurts, right? And so my sense is that during, and this is what the mystics will often say about the dark night of the soul, it's difficult, but it's a period of maturing. And it's actually a necessary phase in the spiritual
like
path.
A consolidation.
And it's like a tunnel that you pass through, but you do come out the other side. And my feeling is that sometime in the mid-80s, George Harrison came out the other side and he was joyful again. But it's a more mature joy, right? Because he's been around the bend, he's seen a few things. And so that's the George Harrison of Cloud Nine and the Traveling Wilburys, and even going all the way up to Brainwashed, his final statement, right? So if we think about Tom Petty and Bob Dylan interacting with George Harrison, especially at that time in his life.
Right.
I mean, I think he was just radiant with Shakti at that point, right? With spiritual right. energy. And what you're saying never occurred to me before you mentioned it to me in the email, but it makes sense. It makes sense with other things I know about George Harrison.
I love it. If like, I want it to be true just because it's great if it's true, right?
Yeah,
it's,
exactly.
It's a great story.
Exactly.
We are running out of time here. I wanted to show you one thing that if we're talking about the interconnectedness of things, mm-hmm. Because I'm on a never ending book purchasing spree, that I can't even keep up with the reading. I was reading the Divine Message by Swami Abedananda.
Yes.
And he cited this book, Krishna. It's a two-volumer by Swami Prabhupada. And it arrived the other day, and I just started flipping through it, and there's an introduction
by George Harrison. Yes. So the proof of the pudding is in the eating, he says there.
Right.
Yeah. I love it.
It's all coming together now.
Right. But before we conclude, I have to show you the t-shirt I'm wearing today. This is George's logo for Dark Horse Records, his own record company. He took from Hindu symbolism for that too. So
wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've got three of these.
We've got to stop, but I don't want to stop. Can we keep doing this? Can we do it again?
Absolutely. Yeah. We just have to find the time and the place, and we'll just continue this conversation. I think that would be wonderful.
This has been the most fun of the conversations I have had on this show. No insult meant to all previous guests. It's just as I explain in Tickled, it's the latest best interview I've ever done.
Well,
so I really appreciate it. Listeners, you can find Dr. Jeff Long on the internet at you're at Elizabethtown. No, you're in
Elizabethtown College.
Elizabethtown College. If you want to do what I did, you can Google away on him and read a million papers. But also you can see his talk, The Yoga of Yoda. There's a video, you can find that online. And if you're like me, you will find it to be some of the most wonderful reading and listening in a long time.
You're very kind of, and I have to say, I'm tickled by everything you've said. I really do appreciate it.
It's a thrill. It was a thrill, and I can't wait to speak to you again soon.
Excellent. Thank you.
You've been listening to How to Tickle Yourself with your host, Duff McDonald, and me, Joey of Rockledge. You can help us by liking, subscribing, and sharing this podcast with others. You can talk to us and see what else is happening on Instagram and Facebook at How to Tickle Yourself. This program was recorded in Studio B of the historic Rockledge Recording Studio. Right here, right now, our original 16-part theme music was written and recorded by the legendary Paul Reddick and Kyle Ferguson of the Sidemen, with Steve Mariner on bass and drums and in the mixing room. This podcast is produced and distributed by Storic Media. Our editor is Oscar Desiderio. Our producers are Kristen Verbitsky and Chuck LaBella. For more information, visit storicmedia.com. That's storicmedia.com.